This is KHOI Dory City Ames. Check out our live stream online at khoifm.org.
Welcome to Local Talk Tuesday, where we explore the people, places, stories, and events of our Central Iowa community. Thank you for tuning in. I am Mike Metz, your host for the hour, along with station manager and engineer, Local Talk's Mike Murphy. And from Milford Township, our good neighbor Patchler Baum is here to help us greet the day and welcome you, our KHOI listeners.
Yes, welcome KHOI listeners. Today a shower is possible early. Intervals of clouds and sunshine, there'll be a high of 79 today. Daytime winds will be east, northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Toward the evening hours, we'll see partly cloudy skies with a low of 56 and a possible thunderstorm on Friday. It is currently 62 degrees.
And we are continuing our monthly segment with the College of Veterinary Medicine out there at Iowa State University. So I'd like to introduce our guest today, Dr. Jamie Copper. She's the equine internal medicine and emergency veterinarian out there at the college. And we're going to talk about foals this morning. Good morning, Jamie.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me here today.
Yeah, it's great for you to join us. So foals, first, that's a name that not everybody is kind of use. It confuses folks when they're using it. If they use it properly, the foal is what? The general young animal. But, you know, a lot of people see a little horse running around and they call it a colt, right? So can you straighten us out on that?
Yeah, for sure. So foals basically refer to baby horse until the time that they are weaned or separated from their mare, aka the mother horse or the female horse. And probably when they're most vulnerable is when we refer to them as neonates. So that time right around birth, the first couple of hours, days, and sort of into weeks of life is when they tend to get the most issues that we encounter for sure. Certainly we think about foals, like when are we worried about them? Honestly, my worry starts before they're even born. So,
sure.
While the mare is, again, female horse is still pregnant. So any, illness that affects the mare can potentially affect that future foal. And then unlike humans and other species, once they hit stage two labor, so that's after the water is broken, due to the placenta type and blood supply to the foal, we only have about 30 minutes to an hour to get them out. Otherwise, we run a very high risk of losing that foal. So we always tell people that if it's been 30 minutes and that foal, after the water has broken and that foal's not out yet, it's time to call your vet and get them, either get headed to them or have them headed to you to hopefully help figure out why that foal is not coming out the way that it should.
The horse is what you could call a prey species. And so they're precocial. Would that be a good term to use? In other words, once they're born within a few hours, they're keeping up with the herd. If I remember, it's that first hour or two after they're born, they've got to get to the mare and start to suckle. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah, and that's a huge, we think about our milestones or goals that we want these foals to meet when they're born, and you know, they really should be breathing regularly by the time they're about a minute or two of age. They should be able to sit in sternal, so sort of sit upright by the time they're about 5 minutes old. By the time they're an hour, they should be up, walking around, able to ambulate. And by the time they're 2 hours of age, they should be nursing and getting that colostrum or first milk. And one of the reasons that's so important for foals is that, again, unlike humans, unlike a lot of other species, they're born what we call aglobulinemic, meaning that they don't have any immunoglobulins to help them from an immune system standpoint. And mom's placenta gets in the way of letting any of those through, And so they have to get colostrum, or they don't have any antibodies to protect them against the world that they are living in and that their mouths are getting all over. And then they only have about 12 hours to get that colostrum. So their GI tracts will only absorb it and let it cross into the bloodstream for those first 12 hours of life. After that, it really starts to drop off significantly. And so not only do we have a closing window of which we can get them, those really important antibodies, through the colostrum or first milk, but until they get that, they're kind of open to the world and all of the germs and bugs that they encounter. And it's not just colostral antibodies that can leak across their GI tract. Bacteria can too. And so they're at a really high risk for sepsis or bacterial infections. So it's kind of a race against time. Who gets across first? Does the bacteria get across first, or do the antibodies get across first? And if the bacteria are getting across first, then they get the upper hand sometimes, and that sets our fold up to be really sick and septic.
Okay, so if the little critter doesn't do this on their own, that means the human's going to have to intervene to help direct the little one to where the mammary glands are on the mare. What happens if the mare decides she's not going to cooperate, or worst case scenario, if the mare were to pass away in labor? What's the alternative for the foal? I assume there's alternatives.
Yeah, there sure are. Great question. So there's a handful of different alternatives. Sometimes, you're right, mares just aren't, especially first-time moms, this is new to them, this is kind of weird, they're not always into it. Sometimes just some help for the mare. Sometimes we can give them a little sedative, or can have someone standing by to help sort of calm her while the foal is trying to nurse and figure that out. Sometimes either the mare just, again, maybe she died during birth, maybe she doesn't have any colostrum, so maybe she didn't make it like she was supposed to, or the foal's just not getting up there in time and getting latched and suckling in time. And so in those cases, your veterinarian can come out. We can get colostrum from the mare if she has it, or some people have colostrum bank, colostrum they've saved from other mares, and we can tube feed that to the foal. So pass a tube through the foal's nose, down its esophagus, and into its stomach, and give them colostrum that way. If that's not available, or we've passed that 12-hour window where we're just not going to absorb the colostrum anymore, and then we can look at plasma transfusion. So basically, there's lots of companies out there that commercially make plasma from horses that donate it, just like people can, and it's frozen. We can thaw it and give it to the foal to give them their antibodies that way.
I've known folks that save colostrum from other mares, freeze it, and then they'll use it with the bottle feeding method, but you've got to take a precaution when you're doing that, because the little critter, the foal, doesn't necessarily, if it isn't suckling right, it might aspirate. You run into problems there, right?
You sure do. I'm glad you brought that up. So we discourage bottle feeding. And unfortunately, foals just aren't calves. So baby cows do great with bottle feeding. You can bottle feed them all day long, and they seem to do great with it. Foals don't do as good of a job at protecting their airway, particularly when the bottle is held high above their heads and they have to lift their heads up high in order to nurse at it. And it runs them at risk for pneumonia. So they end up aspirating the milk. It goes down the wrong tube, ends up going down the trachea into the lungs. And then not only do they not have their immunoglobulins, but now they have stuff in their lungs that shouldn't be there either. And so can set them up for some pneumonia, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, there's going to be folks out there that say, well, how did the horses do this in the wild? They didn't have humans around to help them. I guess that's part of what we would term natural selection. However, we have turned them into a companion animal or a working animal, but we're approaching this from the companion animal aspect this morning. So we've set up some artificial conditions that maybe isn't quite the way nature would have intended it. So in some ways, we've maybe set up some of these problems on our own. it sounds like we've got experts out there that have a good handle on what we need to do. And it's, I would say, especially for the first time horse owner who may decide they want to breed and have a little one running around, that the veterinarian is your best friend.
Yeah, they sure are. So I recommend getting in contact with them and, you know, setting up what's your plan if things don't go right. I mean, if labor is taking longer than 30 minutes after the water's broken, what are you going to do? You want to have that plan ahead of time, not at 2 o'clock in the morning when it tends to be, and scrambling to figure out what that plan is. And then a good plan with your veterinarian afterwards. When do they want a phone call from you? You know, many people will say they want a phone call if the foal's not up and walking by an hour, because if they aren't walking by an hour, they're probably not going to be nursing by 2 hours. And so we'd rather intervene sooner rather than later so that we can prevent them from getting bacterial infections and things like that, as opposed to having to treat them once they've already happened. And oftentimes it's even more cost effective to be seen sooner rather than later. Again, prevention is better than treatment. And then you can follow up sometime between 12 and 24 hours of age and check in on their IgG levels, so that immunoglobulin levels, to say, even if we thought they got up and they nursed, maybe the colostrum wasn't as good as we thought it was. Maybe they were tricking us and they weren't quite nursing as well as we thought they were. So with a simple blood test that many vets can do on the farm, we can assess whether or not did they really get as much immunoglobulin as we thought that they did. And if not, should we be concerned enough to follow up with some plasma? Or maybe we decide that it's close enough and it's okay to keep going forward. Or we find out that it's really, really low and we should intervene again sooner rather.
Well, Dr. Copper, this is Pat Schlarbaum. This whole conversation has me reflecting back to the first time that I watched a foal being born, I guess. And there was a conversation with my grandpa earlier when we got this little beauty of a horse, the mare. And he said, he impressed upon me that to get that little colt up, I remember that he had a time frame. So he knew about that sort of thing. He was very wise in horse husbandry. And so then here we have Beauty, you know, is having her foal, and it's, you know, just kind of all curled up there, laying on the ground, and Beauty starts licking it, and I thought, okay, this, how's he going to get up? But there was some innate behavior that I witnessed that was really touched my heart, because I thought, oh, he's tired. He just got bored. You know, he's not going to want to stand up. And this little foal was then real shakily, you know, for kids that grew up on the farm, to see a little foal standing up for the first time, it was just sort of life unfolding right before our very eyes. And of course, but it was all that innate behavior of it had to stand to go and nurse. And yet what triggered that mechanism of, it's got these legs and they're real wobbly, but it's got to stand. And I remember just being mesmerized by watching this little foal taking its first steps. And so this conversation kind of touches what it is to grow up on a farm, I guess, where you get to see life unfolding in such a manner. So thanks for your very clear reasoning on why this is so important, that the little foal gets up. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. They're lovely little creatures. And most of them do great, just like you said. Yeah. They know, for whatever reason, they know what they need to do. Mom knows what they need to do. Over 90% of them do great. And we never have to see them except for wellness exams, which is how we prefer to see them.
Yeah.
But occasionally it goes awry, and when that happens, we're here for them.
So there's a simple way to remember these things, if I remember, that's kind of the 1, 2, 3. It's the first hour we had to get up and then suckle, and then we have to pass the first feces. It's not really feces, it's because they haven't fed on anything yet, but it's those three steps that help you determine that things are going great. Is that my assessment? Is that correct?
Yep. We call it the 1, 2, 3 rule. So they have to be standing by an hour, nursing by 2 hours, and then mom should pass her placenta by 3 hours. And usually around that time, we are seeing them pass their first species, which they call meconium. It's kind of a darker, almost black or dark brown colored manure feces. That's just all the amniotic fluid that's accumulated sort of when they've been in utero that they're passing and things like that. And then milk feces will come after that, a little bit lighter, almost like a yellow color, a bit softer. And then their meconium.
Okay. And I guess my question to you then is, and we're going to have to wrap up here in the next minute or so, but okay, once this foal has gotten some activity, is nursing, is romping around with mom, following the herd within hours, when do they start to eat? And when they eat, they obviously don't have much for a microbial, a gut microbial. Do they pick that up as they're eating? Does the mare pass some of that on? How do they get that?
Yeah, great question. So a lot of them will eat their mare's poop or their mare's feces, and that's okay. So if you see your foal doing that, that's okay. It's probably the best probiotic they can get.
Exactly. I was just going to
say. So we tell people, we get calls every year, oh my gosh, my foal is eating the mare's poop. What can I do to stop it? And we say, don't let them do that. So it's good for them. And they'll start experimenting with their environment at a young age, mimicking mom. They may not eat a lot of hay and grass and things like that, but they'll get their mouths on it and start working on it.
Well, I know you can see them watching or testing what the mare is testing, so they learn by example. Yeah, talk about nature's probiotic. The animals have it figured out, and we probably did in an earlier period too, but Dr. Copper, is there anything else as we close that you would like to say to our listeners?
I think just thanks for having me here today and getting to talk about foals. And if you need anything to the listeners that have foals, feel free to reach out and give us a call.
Sounds great. And that's Dr. Jamie Copper, the equine internal medicine and emergency veterinarian at the College of Veterinary Medicine at Iowa State University. Thank you, Dr. Copper.
Thank you.
It's training and it's something unknown.
just remaining in the College of Vet Med for a moment, there's the annual Ramsey Lecture, and it's going to be the 100th anniversary of ISU College of Veterinary Medicine's most distinguished alum, Frederick Douglass Patterson. He graduated in 1923, and the College of Vet Med librarian is going to do a presentation on Monday, August 22nd, from 12 to 1 p.m., and open to the public on that, and it's a real interesting story. Our first college graduate there who had quite a lot of instrumental design on the College of Vet Med down at Tuskegee, and has some Tuskegee Airmen connections as well. So try to get in and learn a little bit more about some of the ISU alums. Pat, we have an anniversary for KHOI. What's going on?
Yes, happy birthday, KHOI. This will be our 10th anniversary tomorrow. I think it's August 17th. And we always look into the present and into the future here at KHOI, particularly on Local Talk. But every now and then, I guess it is good to reflect back and kind of go through some things that other people might find interesting. And you know how the format of KHOI's Local Talk has grown and developed over time. We started off with might have just been one segment a week for an hour long topic. Is kind of how we got things started.
And were you involved in those early days?
Well, in the early days. It wasn't until 2013, but we became a station August 17th in 2012. Mm-hmm. So I was hovering somewhat and accepted an invitation by our station manager at that time, Ursula Rudenberg. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my perspectives, I hope, still fare well in the way I was mentored at the time with Ursula Rudenberg. And it whatever the topic was, of course, she has quite a love of the wild ones and outdoors. So my career as a wildlife diversity technician for 33 years. So I did have some outreach into some of the critters that Iowa favors. And
So you obviously had a favorite critter. I know she spoke of these critters on occasion. What could tell us about one?
Well, each winter there were always a lot of bald eagle programs that some years as many as 12 different events that as the river communities kind of discovered this resource, and they would put on these bald eagle appreciation days. And we started the first one in Keokuk, Iowa, 1985. And it just kind of grew from there. So it shortly thereafter, about 1987, I think the Quad Cities started one. But ultimately, about all the river communities would pick them. And we would even host them at Red Rock and down in Pella for Red Rock Reservoir and in Sailorville later in the year. But that was the winter season. But yeah. I remember...
Oh. Well, I was going to say, I think the first time I was on KHOI was on your program. You were hosting, and it was in regard to, it had to do with the Olaf Smedahl Conservation Award. And we had Carl Kurtz on that program, if you remember. That's probably the first rub that I had with the station. But let's get back to Keokuk. That's named after an individual. Do you have the story there?
Well,
he's a chief.
I used to go to the park.
Was he a fox or sock, or was he part of
what nation?
Yeah.
I do not think he was Meskwaki, but quite, you know, I'll look that up.
Okay.
But where you're going with that is a conversation about the sack and the fox.
Yes.
Because there were indications that foxes were, in Iowa, were being somewhat displaced by the coyotes. Coyotes were kind of out in the open territories and prairies and a lot of coyote hunting, but there seemed like the more you hunt them, the more there are. So it's quite a dynamic population of Kayas. And foxes, I was starting to get calls and a lot of concern about people seeing the foxes in towns. And in 2013, it was relatively rare. It was still pretty special. But I know a lot of people are enjoying the foxes that we have right here in urban Ames, Iowa. But most of the communities are starting to notice that there's a fox movement underway. So I thought we'd talk about foxes. And sure enough, through that process, I stumbled onto the detail of the Sac and the Fox Nation. And I asked Jonathan Buffalo, the tribal historian of the Meskwaki Nation, about, so there's Sac, they're related to Meskwaki. And he said, well, they're kind of cousins. But I said, what about the fox? And he said, well, that's an interesting story because in the Meskwaki relocation, or they were kind of driven out of Connecticut and were in upstate New York and then Lake Superior. And it was about that era, hundreds of years ago, that the French trappers were kind of making inroads into certain locales. And when they came upon these native individuals, they, you know, first thing was, well, we're the French, who are you? And they said, well, we're the Fox. And it was kind of a misnomer, according to Jonathan Buffalo, that they got labeled as the Fox because technically they had a Fox clan. Mm-hmm. And in their structure, their tribal system, they have the war clan of the Fox and then the peace clan of the bear, I believe it's possibly the eagle. But anyway, you had these two clans, and during times of peace, the bear clan would be kind of in control. And then in time of war, the fox clan would be so there was a time of peace, but in a time of peace, the fox clan were the security. They would kind of roam the borders. And so consequently, of course, those were the first people that the French met. And they were kind of tagged as the Fox at that time. So as time evolved, the government kind of lumped together the Sac and the Fox. And you'll still see that term today. And yet it's really the Fox clan of the Meskwaki people. And by golly, just the other day, I read in the paper that Jim Thorpe, the great athlete of the Olympic era back at the turn of the 20th century, was a member of the Sac and Fox tribe. And I thought, well, there it is once again.
And for our listeners, they don't realize that he got paid a minuscule amount for playing a ball game. Oh, and then his Olympic medals were all taken away while they were just reinstated here.
Yeah, so he's a current event now.
Yeah.
His family received the, I think it was the pentathlon and the decathlon or the 10.
Decathlon.
Decathlon, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So those are the stories that some of the things that KHOI now we're reflecting on our 10-year anniversary. And that was kind of my first show.
Yeah.
And just sharing some of the things that I learned. And there's a whole lot of other things about foxes. But I think people can enjoy the foxes. They are wild. And they are coming into areas like Ames.
And you have a program on that we can...
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you can go into the archives.
Yep. And we'll make sure we get that URL link in the script for
You can find it on March 3rd, 2013.
Okay.
And yeah, so happy birthday, KHOI. Long may we fly these, keep the airways flowing.
Thank you, Pat.
Yeah.
Life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help.
And we're going downtown to visit with Susan Guiazda this morning. Good morning, Susan.
I love that theme music. That is very, very peppy.
Well, Petula has a way with downtown.
Every morning.
There you go. It's just kind of an uplifting tune, I think. So.
It does. You just start humming along with it.
Susan, what have you got for our listeners this morning?
Well, just a reminder that today is the Bike and Pedestrian Master Plan Workshop. Again, that's a listening and learning session with the Ames City Council and the Public Works Department and their consultant tool design. And that is really a workshop today, not necessarily for public input. It really is to ensure that this project gets kicked off on the right path. It's to come to consensus on the goals and decide about a public input strategy. So this isn't, while certainly public input will form and make this plan, this is just the starting point. And so it's really a learning session for staff, and it's a learning session for the consultant, and it's a way that everybody can make sure that we start this project on the same page. So I just want to set expectations that there will be opportunities for public input, but I'm not sure tonight is going to be one of those. This, to me, has been presented as a learning opportunity. So just so everybody understands that, if you can't come to City Hall tonight at 6 p.m., you can watch on our YouTube or Facebook pages. We also stream off our website, cityofames.org, so you can take advantage of watching this show live, or it goes into the archives the very next morning, and you can watch it at your convenience.
Okay. And since this is really the public doesn't have a role in this, will they have opportunities in the future to provide some input?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had Damian Fragetzer, our traffic engineer, on the show before, and he's talked about a really robust public input process that will cover two semesters at Iowa State, so we can make sure that we incorporate student participation in that, but also gives us multiple possibilities to get citizen input on what where improvements are needed and what the future of non-motorized transportation looks like in this community. As somebody who's been involved in the climate action planning, that's a big part of what we're looking at into the future, is how are people going to get around with non-fossil fuel. And so it's interesting to see how these plans will kind of work together and support one another. The Bike and Pedestrian Master Plan is actually an update. It's not starting from scratch, but it should really support the climate action plan, which we're working on as well.
Okay, thank you for that. Susan, you have a guest this morning. I don't know if I've ever met this individual. He looks pretty energetic, though. Who have we got?
So our director of Ames Electric Services, Donald Kahn, is joining with us today. You know, summer is our peaking season for our utility, our electric utility, and I know it's been a busy summer for Don. We've avoided some peaks, which have been really difficult but very important. And I thought maybe we'd have Mr. Kahn give us some updates on what he's been up to these days.
Well, welcome, Donald.
Thank you, Susan. thank you very much. So, first of all, happy 10th anniversary. I know it's tomorrow, but I won't be on tomorrow. So 10 years is a great accomplishment. And I've had the pleasure of being in your studio, and it is a wonderful, wonderful place to be, and I'm glad you're where you're at. And in fact, I was hoping, I even talked to Susan, that can I do it in person. And she says, well, there's a Zoom, but I'd like to get back into your studio sometime.
Well, there'll be an opportunity when we have our celebration a little bit later, and we'll make announcements on that.
Oh, that would be terrific. Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, we wake up to a day like today where it's like 65 out and think this is a beautiful summer morning. But it wasn't too long ago where we had that extremely hot weather. And as Susan mentioned, we were very close to hitting a new peak. And what that means is, what an electric peak means is, it's for 1 hour when all of our customers are using as much energy as they need to get their things done.
Mm-hmm.
We look at, or we think about a peak more from a standpoint that we're growing, and you'd think most businesses want to grow, but we're at a point now in our facilities, in our generation, that as we grow, we have to start thinking about how are we going to serve customers in the future, and where are we going to get that new capacity? Do we have to build something? Do we go and buy something onto the market? Do we, maybe maybe it's something there are actually, it's kind of interesting, there's generation auctions that you go into. But all of those things typically would cost us more money to do. And ideally, if we can keep our peak down, we don't have to buy or build that next resource, and we actually keep our rates lower for our customers. So we're always working to serve our customers with everything that they need, but keep it at a price that is reasonable and affordable for everyone.
When you do need to go out onto the market and purchase extra energy, how far ahead? What's your lead time on that? You almost have to make some predictions, don't you?
Yeah, there's two different things that we need. And you mentioned the word energy, and a lot of people use that to mean all of the things. So we need capacity. In other words, we need the capability to produce the energy. That's the physical asset, so that we have to maintain about 110% of our load. And all utilities do this for the reason that if any one unit trips offline, there is other available resources to pick it up. And that's how we avoid blackouts and brownouts, is because there's an overabundance of generation throughout the country. In our case, throughout Iowa is what we rely on. When you talk, and to plan for that, we plan multiple years in advance. If I were to build a new plant, I'd probably need 5 years to plan for that next generator. That's on the capacity side. And that's to meet that 1 hour every year when people demand the most from us that we can give them. On energy, which is what you mentioned, energy we serve on an instantaneous basis all the time. Our planning horizon for that is one day. So right now I've got Colin in my office. He's doing forecasting of what are our loads look like, what's the weather going to be like. He's looking at how much wind there's going to be. We have wind resources, and he needs to know how much wind generation we're going to be putting out. He's looking to a lesser extent on how sunny it's going to be today, because we have a solar farm down by the airport. So he wants to know how much that's going to produce. He then looks at our native generation, and then also looks to what's called the grid or the energy market, and he'll put a forecast in for 24 hours for tomorrow. That gets submitted today, and then we find out what available resources there are from the grid, and that's how we plan. We're planning 24 hours in advance.
Okay. So if something comes up that you didn't plan for, that 110% you were talking about will help stave off a potential brownout or blackout, at least for the short term. Is that right?
That is right. So let's say there's, and our generation isn't large enough to make a huge swing. So if one of our plants happens to drop offline, a boiler tube leak, for instance, it wouldn't really affect too many other things. Other utilities can ramp up ever so slightly to cover that loss. It's the larger units, the 500, the 600, the 800 megawatt units, that when they trip offline, you need a lot of people responding a little bit. We'll even respond to a small extent when a large unit, what we say, trips offline or has a mechanical failure.
What do you do in the case of, for example, the sun has some effects on the electrical grid, and hopefully this will never happen, but what if a transformer, one of the bigger transformers, went out? Can you just take something off the shelf, or where are we at on something like that?
That's a very good question, and when you say it, I hope it almost never happens. It happens more often than hopefully our customers even know.
Yeah.
Because the beauty of it is most our system has redundancy and almost triple redundancy. And by that I mean, so we have a major power line that runs over to Boone, Mm-hmm. We have a major power line that runs down to Allaman, and we have a major power line that runs down to Ankeny. And any two of those lines can either be out of service for maintenance, or let's say you have a tree. I have driven by our line down to Ankeny, and near the wastewater plant, there happen to be a lot of trees.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not trimmed correctly, it could, on windy days, fall into the power line. So the system that it's hooked up to, the breakers and stuff, are similar to breakers in your home, where if a cord shorts out, that breaker will open. The beauty with our system is we can feed most loads, most customers, from multiple directions. So if a breaker opens on one end, we can close it on the other end and pick them back up or begin serving them again. And hopefully that takes less than seconds. And I do mean less than seconds. It's like cycles. So you may just see a little blink when you see your lights, and that actually was an outage on the system, and the system itself cleared the problem and restored power. On larger outages, let's say it is a tree in a major power line, we like to leave that open so that we can send a crew out to make sure that we're not closing that line back in. With the tree in there, it could start the tree on fire. Or if there's wires on the ground, it could be a safety hazard.
Mm-hmm.
So in cases like that, we'll send a crew out. And from a safety, that usually takes upwards of a half hour, 45 minutes on a simple outage, just so that we can walk the line or drive the line and make sure everything is safe. That's why those outages take a little bit longer, because we're being particularly careful and safety conscious so that we don't hurt any of the environment or people or anything else that could be obstructing the line.
That's reassuring, because I could envision, at least some folks, I'm sure, see that Don's got to get up at 2 in the morning and run down, and there's this huge knife switch that he's got to throw to set things up. It's a little more automated, and it sounds like you've got a lot of staff that can handle that kind of a situation. I like the word redundancy in things like this, Don.
Thank you. And we're continuing to look at that from a generation standpoint. We're examining, as Susan mentioned, the Climate Action Plan. We're looking to increase our amount of solar, our amount of wind, and we need redundancy there. So when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining, we have that capability to continue to serve our customers the energy that they need whenever they need it.
You know, you bring up the Climate Action Plan, and a little birdie told me that later this fall, you and Susan and a couple of other individuals are going to be offering an OLLIE class on Climate Action Plan updates. Is that correct?
That is correct. I don't have the dates off the top of my head, but Susan, I know, has those dates right at her fingertips.
All I know is it's early November.
Yeah.
A little bit away.
Yeah.
Very early in November.
So you got time to get your redundancy ducks in a row, Don.
Yeah.
Just for our listeners, I attended that course last year, and it's amazing the things that you learn in what the city of Ames is doing as far as climate action. I would highly recommend folks to attend that. And I believe that's going to be, is that maybe a hybrid where there'll be Zoom and in-person attendance this year? I'm not exactly sure. I don't want to.
I think it is. Now that you say that, there are, prior to the OLLIE, you speakers attend a class, and I think they explain the technology, and I'm not positive on that. I did not go to the class, but I thought they helped you so that the speakers could be better and everyone gets a good learning experience from the class.
Now, so that our listeners aren't confused, you didn't go to the class that helped train for the Zoom and the hybrid. You were actually at the class to help facilitate the Climate Action Plan. But Don, we've got about less than a minute. Is there anything else you want to instill upon our listeners, wrap it up a little bit?
You bet. Again, going back after those hot days we had just a few weeks ago, we were very, very close to setting a peak. So close, in fact, that for those that thought about it, for those that heard the message on KHOI and said, okay, I'm going to wait to not wash my clothes or I'll do dishes later, mm-hmm. 200 kilowatts is not a lot in our world. And it was those people that took that last little step and waited to do their energy use that kept us from hitting a new peak. So I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone out there.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of us around here thinking those same things. And when we talk to people, we mention it as well. So thank you, Don. Don Kamm from our Electrical Services Division. He's the director there. And Susan Guiazda, Public Information Officer, thank you, and we'll see you again.
Thank you very much.
And now we're handing some applause off to Leo Timms. Leo, welcome. It's been a while, I think, since I've seen you in person with maybe Dave White or Skip Walter or somebody like that. What are you doing here?
Well, I'd like to tell you I was hiding, but we all know what the last 2 years have brought, right? And many of us didn't see anybody.
Right.
Why am I here today? Because for the last 2 years, the Senior Variety Show was on hold, just like every other program and every other thing we did. But the show goes on.
Yeah.
So this Friday night, 7:30, and Saturday matinee at 2 a.m., we will have the 26th Annual Senior Variety Show at the City Auditorium.
Okay.
And we're excited. We're excited to bring it back. We've got a great slate of people and a fun time for everybody, from young to old. It's not just for seniors. You just have to be a senior, which is over 60, to be a performer in the show.
Yeah, now we had Tyrone Horneye in here, and he didn't seem real excited, but he did get his message across last week.
If you go to the show, Tyrone is great. Yeah. But he's not really, he's not jumping up and down. He's in some really neat vignettes with Kay Berger, and Skip is just Skip. But he'll be terrific. They will be terrific as part of their vignettes in the show.
Sure. Now, Leo, what part do you play in the Senior Variety Show?
Well, I think number one is I turned 66 years ago, and I'd done, there's a lot of things people can do for the show. I've ushered, done other things, but when I was 60, people asked if I'd be in the show. So I've done some singing, some dancing, but I jumped in. They had a board spot, and I decided to jump on the board because I think we all need to be a part of it. You know, one thing I'd say, and you're going to see at the show this week, everybody looks for the show every year, but when the pandemic hit, our big dilemma was, how do we continue to showcase senior talent?
Right.
And should we be showcasing it not just one day a year? And so in the last 2 years, we have monthly newsletters we put out that have YouTube videos and have updates. We've developed musical telegrams, so I've been a part of that. But I will be in the show. I will be singing a couple duets with different ladies who certainly are dragging my talent along. They're very, very good, Alice Thompson and Pat Meek, outstanding performers. And then I sing in a couple of the senior groups, so the Golden Case Singers, and then, believe it or not, Heartland Songbirds and Green Hills has merged. And so I'll be singing in a new group called the Greenbirds.
Okay. The Greenbirds. Let's see. Pat, do we know of a... we digress.
Olive Sided Flycatcher.
There we go. Leo, where can folks get tickets?
Sure. I mean, if you know somebody in the Senior Variety Show, you look at the flyers, you can contact us in our website or our phone numbers. But right now, tickets are available at 5 outlets across the county. So they're at Busy's Boutique, which is up in North Grand Mall, Bergie's Coffee, which is the North Grand Mall one. They're available on Main Street at Worldly Goods. They're available in Nevada at the Ben Franklin store and at the RSVP Senior Center in Story City. But I would also tell anybody, if you have access to any of the retirement communities in town, whether it's Northcrest, Bethany Life in Story City, Green Hills, I know there are people there that also have them. If not, give me a call.
Yeah.
Figure out my number and and call me. We've got them. Or if you don't get them, right, it's nice. You buy them ahead of time. If you go to the door, so it's a little bit of an advantage to buy them up front, but certainly we'll have tickets available at the door also.
Okay, thank you for that. I know I've bumped into folks that have had tickets out of their hanging out of their pockets, and they just kind of nudge up to you and that kind of thing. So that Tyrone Horneye is one of those guys. So, okay, again, what are some of the other acts? You've got music acts. You obviously have some little skits. Are there any things we should be looking for?
Well, I think you could say, are we looking for this? Everyone is individual and unique. We actually had we put together the first act last night. So it was about 17 or 18 little vignettes or things. And I'll just tell you, there's a mixture of individuals. There's a mixture of groups. Duets, 6 people, 25 people. There is singing. There is dancing. There is musical instruments. There is some reading and poems. And, you know, it's hard to highlight any one of them. You know, everybody wants showy and dancing, but everybody as a senior has different talents.
Sure.
And I think what people are going to come and see is an incredible, diverse group of talented individuals in a myriad of ways to showcase senior talent and celebrate aging. And I would say that's what people should be excited about.
How does one go about if they're interested in maybe breaking out of their shell or stepping away from the wall and maybe trying to sign up for this? Who do they see? How do they get a hold of you folks?
Sure. Well, you know, we have a website and we've got an email address, but you're going to see at the show this time, we have a monthly newsletter that we now do. And we send out, and it shows previous videos and it's got information. But we're going to have people sign up for that. And in that, people will see. You know, the only thing, you have to be over 60 to be in the show. But other than that, you know, we have auditions and we do things, but come to the table with something. Everybody's got a talent. Again, it could be reading a verse. It could be a poem. It could be a funny skit. It could be a song. Not everybody has to be a singer and a dancer. And it's open to everybody.
Well,
so that's what I'd say.
And it sounds like you need help as well behind the scenes. You yourself said that's how you started. Get involved as far as ushering, seating. I'm sure there's scene changes and all that type of thing that is involved. So there must be a lot of folks involved in those areas that we don't see, but the show goes on not realizing there's a lot of folks behind those scenes.
Exactly. You know, I mean, through the year, we have a board and we have other people, but it's not just the board. There are a lot of active people that are contributing, whether it's newsletters, musical telegrams. But the day of the show, you're right. It's like anything else. You go out and you perform. But what really is the key is the people who set the stage up in the background and the music and who's moving the props in or out. You've all been to plays. And we have a great group of people. They were there last night. It's amazing. The show runs, yes, we have our little glitches, but it runs like clockwork, and it's really the behind-scene people. So thank you for saying that, and for us to say thank you to them, and we'll thank them at the show. They're an incredibly integral part.
There must obviously be a traffic cop on all of this, or is that a shared responsibility, or is there somebody charged with that responsibility?
You know, I'd say not. It doesn't fall on one person's shoulders. We've got different groups. So we've got a production group, a creative group, the board, and we all brainstorm. So we do have a show director or directors who really direct how the show lays out, the acts and everything. We have someone who takes charge of the stage. Jerry Derner is a great person behind the scene, although as she turns 60, she's going to be in the show one of these days. But she's the stage, she's the house manager. So managing people coming in, managing ushers, ticket takers. So what's really neat is we have a group of people. Yes, we have a president of the board, but we have a group of people who step up and divvy up responsibilities.
Okay. One more time, Leo, when and where, and go from there.
You bet. So Senior Variety, 26th Annual Senior Variety Show this Friday night. They're at the City Auditorium this Friday night, 7:30 p.m. Saturday's matinee is 2 p.m. It's about a two-hour show, 35 individual or group acts, okay, and a lot of fun for everybody.
All right, down at the Ames Auditorium.
You bet.
Thank you, Leo Timms, for the Senior Variety Show, and break a leg.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity, and I can't break a leg before Friday or Saturday, I'll try. Thanks.
There you go. Thanks. Thanks, Leo. Thanks to station manager Mike Murphy for engineering this morning's local talk, and Pat Schlierbaum, and a tug of the toque to producer Lynn Carey for all her assistance. Our guests today include Dr. Jamie Copper, who is a veterinarian with Iowa State University. She's the equine specialist there. Susan Guiazda and Don Combs with the City of Ames. And we are going to continue our historic look back at KHOI. I have been your host, Mike Metz.
KHOI provides a platform for citizens and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI, your community nonprofit, nonpartisan media. Remember that you can also hear this online at khoifm.org and find links to our guests and information you heard during this program. Please consider becoming a member and making KHOI your community radio station with your financial support, especially during our birthday, our 10th birthday this month. Go to our website at khoifm.org and press the yellow donate button to begin the process of becoming a member.
Stay tuned for Democracy Now!, followed by All Things Piano at 9 a.m. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting KHOI. And we'll see you again on the radio.
FM, KHOI, Story City, Ames, celebrating 10 years on the air.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!